Camilla Chester is a local writer whom I first met when she took part in the St Albans Lit Fest 2016. As an author of fiction for children, she was also one of the judges in the Lit Fest's short story competition for young writers. The interview with her and with her colleague Deborah Heath, as well as the discussion about the competition and the stories themselves, can be heard again through the website of the local talking newspaper. That's sadtn.org.uk. Then go to the tab Listen Online and then into the archive Talking Bookshelf. Camilla chose a book for our discussion, which I also found absolutely fabulous, but which we also found difficult to discuss without giving too much away. Now, if you know the work of Maggie O'Farrell, you'll understand why. And if you don't know her work, I do urge you to give her a try. She really does write fantastic stories. The extracts from the audiobook narrated by Karen Cass are by courtesy of Caliber Audio, a specialist charity providing audiobooks for those who, for reasons of sight loss or other factors, are unable to read the printed version. Now, difficult though this particular book was to discuss, because it would be so easy to give away too much in error and thereby ruin it for new readers, I hope you'll enjoy hearing about it, and above all, I hope you enjoy catching up with this novel and others by this writer.
Well, the book is called The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, and it's by a writer that I would love to be. Most writers have a writer that they aspire to be, and she's called Maggie O'Farrell, and she writes in a beautiful, crisp way and is able to get really inside characters' heads and make you really feel for the characters, which is a real skill.
You say she's a writer that you want to be. What is it about her that you would love to be able to do yourself?
I think she is a sort of minimalist in that every word that she uses earns its place to be there. There's no padding or fluffing or anything that's in there that doesn't need to be in there, which can be a little, makes it a little bit harder work for a reader, I think, because you have to persevere to get used to the style. It's very, very good writing. And yes, I would love to be able to write like that without having to go off on big tangents and waffle a bit. She's very skilled.
And one of the things she does very well is get inside the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three principal characters in this, although in the flashbacks there are other people there as well.
Mm.
But the three principal women, Iris, the younger woman.
That's right,
The older woman, Esme, we'll talk about in a moment, and her sister, Kitty. And it's quite an art to get into. First of all, there's a generational gap, isn't there? She sort of is the younger one.
Yes.
And yet she also manages to make you feel that she's the other two as well.
Yes. It feels to me that she's the younger, even though the most interesting character is Esme, and obviously the book is her life story. But I feel that the author has a handle on Iris and is so sympathetic to Iris's cause, if you like, that you almost believe that the writer is Iris, which is a huge skill to be able to do that, to be able to put herself in her shoes that much. And actually, Iris carries the story, so we're finding out about Esme through Iris's investigations and the fact that she's come into contact with Esme and who is this woman and what's her story. We learn it through Iris's eyes, in a way.
This would be a book that would be very easy to give away.
Yes,
what's going to happen next.
To be really careful, don't we, what we say.
So let's begin at the beginning. There's a lot of uncertainty of, and I love the opening because it uses the word perhaps or perhaps not several times.
Well, beginnings have to work very hard, don't they? Because they have to encourage you to carry on reading and they have to paint a tone and a picture of the book. And she does this beautifully because she's sort of drawing you in as a reader. She's saying, let us begin with two girls at a dance, or perhaps that's not the beginning. And then she paints the picture of the girls at the dance, but then quickly jumps ahead in time. And so you're thinking, well, I had that picture in my head now of the girls. So where are we going to come back to that? And who is she now and what's happened in between? So you're already starting to ask those important questions, which is what she wants you to do all the way through the book. And it's really quite far into the book where you find out who those girls are and how they fit into the story. And it's very skillfully done. I think she does a very good job of painting a vivid picture, and in different countries as well. So you're not quite sure at that time where you are in history and where you are geographically. And the book covers various different settings and locations in time very skillfully and believably. And so I think the beginning is just wonderful. It pulls you straight in.
Let us begin with two girls at a dance. They are at the edge of the room. One sits on a chair, opening and shutting a dance card with gloved fingers. The other stands beside her, watching the dance unfold. The circling couples, the clasped hands, the drumming shoes, the whirling skirts, the bounce of the floor. It is the last hour of the year and the windows behind them are blank with night. The seated girl is dressed in something pale, Esme forgets what, the other in a dark red frock that doesn't suit her. She has lost her gloves. It begins here. Or perhaps not. Perhaps it begins earlier, before the party, before they dressed in their new finery, before the candles were lit, before the sand was sprinkled on the boards, before the year whose end they are celebrating began. Who knows? Either way, it ends at a grill covering a window with each square exactly two thumbnails wide.
We're already into the mind and thoughts of Esme, the woman that does the disappearing trick, as it were, this ability to be invisible, which we'll explain or try to come to later. We must be giving the impression that it's quite complicated, but actually it's so skillful that you never think in reading or listening to it that you're lost, because you follow it through. One reviewer said she didn't put it down till she'd finished it. She read it in one go.
Yeah.
It's not that long. So we've got a sense of the style and the crispness, you called it, of the writing. And we've got three characters. And we're beginning to sense something even from the beginning. This perhaps not. Where do we go from here? You talked about time jumping, and that's often quite confusing in a novel it's easier if it goes from A to B to C to D.
Yes.
You follow it through. But it's not impossible, this one, is it? It's not impossible to follow.
No, not at all. I think because she's so good at getting inside characters, you can tell almost within a few words who you're listening to at that time, who is telling the story. So is it Esme, is it Kitty, or is it Iris? And you know straight away who it is. And then you can almost place where they are as well from what she literally has the characters only talking about the things as she encounters them. So they're exploring their environment around them. And so as a reader, you can tell very clearly where you're at in the story. So, and she does that within pages. You know, it's not, some authors will chunk information into quite clear structured sections, but she jumped quite freely within chapters, between characters and between time settings, and you can easily follow it. It's not confusing, really.
Because in the audiobook, although it's one narrator, she adopts an Edinburgh accent,
yes,
a little, and a Scottish, slightly different Scottish accent, I suspect, for Esme. But Kitty has I think it's Edinburgh. They are the two sisters. So these are different voices. Does the text give you those voices?
Yes, the text has a sort of visual clue to show you who's speaking. Kitty tends to have dashes at the beginning and end. So it's not in different font or anything like that, but it gives you an idea. But you don't even need that, really, because the writing's so skillful, because you can tell from the words that she's using and the phrases who's talking. Of course, you haven't got a whole medley of characters, so it's not a very confusing book. You've only got those three main characters, and they are the narrators. So it's quite easy to follow.
The younger character, Iris, she in fact has her own narrative with other things happening to her, which do not appear to be relevant to the two sisters. Very relevant to her, Iris, and aspects of her life, which are quite, she's got quite a complicated life in
she
her own
has,
right.
She has, yeah, she has. And they're like subplots, aren't they? You know, whenever you're writing, so when I'm writing, you always have the main plot of the story. And in this case, it's Esme Lennox and what's happened to her. But you also have little subplots to keep the reader interested and engaged. And they also tell you a little bit about the character and what sort of person they are and why, and explain why they act the way that they do. So Iris has got a very complicated love life and a modern day story, which can pull the reader along as well and actually help you to empathise with that character. And it makes the book even more interesting and layered.
Esme, we see her from very early age. We see her as a child. Things happen. Some fundamental things happen that dictate the rest of her life and the rest of Kitty's life. It's in India. She and Kitty are two sisters. They have a brother called Hugo.
The time setting is important. So you're talking about a lifespan. So in the present day, Kitty is an elderly lady. So you're talking sort of 30s in India, 1930s. And so the role of women would have been very different at that time. And the perception of women in society was very different. And so the book addresses those feminist issues of how society treated women and how different Esme's life might have been had she been born in a different era. You just have to follow along, really, with Esme's journey and wonder how different it might have been for her had she been born at a different time.
The actions that were taken by her and by her sister have fundamental consequences.
Yeah.
In perhaps in a harsher way than they do for Iris. She does things that are odd, but she doesn't suffer so much.
I think it's because of when she was born. And I think if Esme had been born in Iris's time, which is what the writer's done very skillfully, she's shown this character, Iris, living a life that's actually a lot more dramatic and confrontational than Esme ever was, but doesn't have the same fallout in any sense of the word that poor Esme did. I think that's what it really makes you think, goodness, aren't we lucky now as opposed to then?
Something happened which resulted in Esme being locked away, which is not uncommon again in the 30s and up to later periods. Young women were often put away into institutions for all sorts of different reasons. And the unravelling of the reasons behind that, of what drives this forwards, and you learn more and more as you're going along. The title.
It's difficult to say without giving too much of the story away, but she has been incarcerated, as you say, and so in a sense she has vanished from society. But also it's got a double meaning, because she has a coping mechanism, if you like, to be able to deal with the harshness of what she's doled out in life, and it's described beautifully in the book.
The girl is talking to the night porter, and he is saying no. His mouth a round shape, his head swinging back and forth. He is saying no. He is saying not authorised. And the girl is gesturing. She looks tense, her shoulders hunched, her brow creased. And Esme sees what might be. She shuts her mouth, closes her throat, folds her hands over each other, and she does the thing she has perfected. Her speciality. To absent yourself. To make yourself vanish. Ladies and gentlemen, behold. It is most important to keep yourself very still. Even breathing can remind them that you are there, so only very short, very shallow breaths, just enough to stay alive and no more. Then you must think yourself long. This is the tricky bit. Think yourself stretched and thin, beaten to transparency. Concentrate. Really concentrate. You need to attain a state so that your being, the bit of you that makes you what you are, that makes you stand out, three-dimensional in a room, can flow out from the top of your head until, ladies and gentlemen, until it comes to pass that...
The character's way of trying to make sense of what's going on and being able to cope, logically none of it makes sense for her. It's her way of trying to distance herself from it so that the pain's not so strong. And so she describes that really well. And there's other bits in the book where she detaches herself from her body almost. It throws you because you're thinking, well, she seems perfectly sane, but is she not sane? And then, of course, you're comparing her to her sister and you're thinking, well, is Kitty the sane one or not the sane one? So it's challenging your beliefs all the way through.
And you said that in a way this is a feminist book. Does it take our understanding of women's place in society forward?
I think it shows how far feminism has come. If you look at that one lifetime and what was acceptable then and what's acceptable now. The way Esme's quite amazed by Iris is so lovely to read. But it does show that we still have a little way to go, really, in terms of women's rights. It's a beautiful book that shows a difficult subject in a very gripping, page-turning way. There aren't many writers that can actually write beautifully and also tell an amazing story. And the whole story is very fast-paced. It's really gripping. But just unpicking this puzzle of what's happened to her and why is she where she is and what's going to happen. And here you've got these three characters and the two sisters are in conflict. And you're trying to puzzle out how she can possibly strive in this world.
Because it does, and it holds you right to the end, because the final pages are fundamental.
I mean, the ending is just, we can't talk about the ending, obviously.
We can't even talk about it two-thirds of the way through. You were talking about style, we were talking about the two sisters and Kitty, the one perhaps we said less about.
We're told fairly early on that Kitty is in a nursing home and that there's some issues of dementia. So I think it's the writer's way of showing her thought patterns and the way she jumps in time and the way she compares it to her sister, which again goes back to the way you're challenging which one is crazy, really. And she jumps in to what's happening with her at that present time with staff in the nursing home, to snippets of her sister and the relationship they had, whether that was in India or in Edinburgh. And that brings a narrative forward and tells you, informs you more, but you're questioning all the time which is the reliable narrator, which is the one that's giving giving me the truth here? Because, of course, they've all got their own perceptions on what happened historically. And I think that's why she does it like that. So she gives you little bits of information to help you put the pieces of the puzzle together and actually demonstrate how Kitty's mind works in that sort of fluttering way that she's not concentrating on one topic for too long.
Mine was white organdy with an orange blossom trim, and I didn't want the holly to tear it. So she carried the wreath. She cared little for her dress. Scarlet velvet she'd wanted, crimson. But she got burgundy taffeta. And she said it didn't fit properly. The seams weren't straight, and even I could see that, but such things mattered so much to her that... A girl comes to crouch in front of me, and I see that she's unlacing my shoes and taking them off. And I say to her, I took it, and I've never told anyone. The girl looks up at me and she titters. You tell us every day, she says. I know she's lying, so I say, it was my sister's, you know. And she just turns to speak to someone over her shoulder and...
It almost flings you back to the very beginning again.
Yes.
Doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
The opener.
Yes, it does.
The girls, the dress, the...
The writers brought that scene in right at the beginning of the dress, and then it's not mentioned again till quite later in the book. And you're like, oh, yes, you know, what were those girls? And now you know who they are and you know what stage you're at in their lives. And so you're looking at that whole scene again with fresh eyes. So she's very clever that she brings you round again in a full circle. Mm.
These three women are so real and so believable and so different, and yet they're all telling the same story. The story is coming out.
I wonder how much she cut out. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? To get it so concise the way it is, but actually tell such a lot of information and give you such a lot of story. So it makes me wonder how much would have been red-penned.
We haven't been able to talk about it in the way that one would talk about a Dickens, or because you could talk about the characters and the plot developing, because we can't give away. It's complicated, but also easy to say too much.
Yes.
Thank you for everything that you
have
said.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Anyone who is introduced to Maggie O'Farrell, I think you'll really, really enjoy her book.
The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox by Maggie O'Farrell is narrated on the audiobook by Karen Cass. It lasts for approximately 6.5 hours. And we're very grateful to Caliber Audio for allowing us to have a copy of this so that we can use extracts to illustrate our discussion. The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.